1 Corinthians chapter 8. Now, concerning food offered to idols, we know that all of us possess knowledge. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. If anyone imagines that he knows something, he does not yet know as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, he is known by God. Therefore, as to the eating of food offered to idols, we know that an idol has no real existence, and that there is no God but one. For although there may be so-called gods in heaven or on earth, as indeed there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, from whom all things and for whom we exist, and one Lord Jesus Christ, through whom are all things and through whom we exist. However, not all possess this knowledge, but some, through former associations with idols, eat food as really offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. Food will not commend us to God. We are no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. But take care that this right of yours doesn't somehow become a stumbling block to the weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will he not be encouraged, if his conscience is weak, to eat food offered to idols? And so, by your knowledge, this weak person is destroyed, the brother for whom Christ died. Thus, sinning against your brothers and wounding their conscience when it is weak, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble.
Great, thank you very much, Dan, for reading for us there. As Dave mentioned earlier on, we're returning to our series in 1 Corinthians. We were here last year. And the Corinthian church has a lot to teach us, I think. But one of the main things that the Corinthian church has to teach us is that the early church was not perfect. Plenty of times we kind of think, if only life was like it was in the early church, if only we could get back to those good old days. Well, the guys in Corinth weren't particularly great. They weren't the kind of Christians that you would like to necessarily emulate. Corinth was a church where people were suing one another. They were not dealing with sexual immorality in the church. The richer members weren't looking out for the poorer members. They were getting drunk on the communion wine. The meetings were a free-for-all with anyone and everyone getting in on the act. They were not a great church. So that's quite reassuring, isn't it? Because we're a bit like that. Maybe not in the same ways, but we're a bunch of fallen people who are getting on as well as we possibly can. And Paul wrote a letter to those guys. So we can learn from the kind of issues, the kind of things that Paul has to say to a bunch of Christians who are trying to make the most of their Christian life in a difficult culture, a difficult context. Some of you will remember that Corinth was a city full of different gods and idols. Different temples. It was a major port. People came from all over the world and they brought their own little deities with them. And so worshipping these idols became part of everyday life. So you walk into a shop, and as you walk into the shop, there would be the little idol to shopkeepers or whatever it is, and you'd stroke his head, and somehow that would give you good luck or providence in your transaction. Or maybe you pop over to a friend's house, and as you go in through the door, there is the household god, and you need to pop in perhaps a couple of coins to make sure that you have a good visit to this particular people. And just before you have your tea, the people having cooked the tea would then offer it a little bit to this idol to make sure that everyone enjoys the food. And it's all, you see, idol worship was all part of an everyday culture. Now, in this city, there are a bunch of people who used to live like that. But they were converted. They were brought the gospel by Paul, who planted a church there. And as they became a Christian, they turned from one way of living to a new way of living. They repented from an old way of life. And they started living a new way of life. You see, many of the Christians in Corinth would have been brought up in this kind of heavily religious background. But when someone becomes a Christian, their life is turned on its head. They repent from worship of idols to serving the true and living God. They've been rescued, they've been saved from idol worship. So it's a bit like this picture. It's an illustration that we've used a few times before. Here is a guy sitting on an upturned boat. He's there, you see him? There's his head and his arms and his legs. That guy is a guy by the name of Timothy Rowley. And this boat is the Aquila. In 2009, it capsized off the coast of Scotland. There were four people on the boat originally. Three of them died. They drowned in the water surrounding it. Only one man survived, Timothy Rowley. He sat on this upturned boat, waiting for the Sea King helicopter to come and rescue him. So he was saved from the waters around him. The waters that had killed his friends. He had escaped from the waters, been rescued, so to speak, and he was sat there on his boat. And this is going to be forming the background to this kind of story we're thinking about today. Those waters, those things that entice, those things that have the potential to kill, are what we might call idols. The things that we worship or might worship, the things we've been saved from worshipping by Jesus' death and his resurrection. Yet he now is saved, yet living in a world which is surrounded by all the things that he wants. Was threatened by. The question is, how does he keep on living? How does he keep on going? How do we as Christians keep on going in a world surrounded with idols that perhaps we might be tempted to go and worship? And how do we look after one another in the way that we do that? Now, I think there are two potential ends of the spectrum we could go to on this one. There's one end of the spectrum which says, the world is terrible out there. The world's really bad, it's full of danger. All these different gods that maybe we might have worshipped in the past, like materialism or love or family or anything like that. Oh, it's terrible. So we kind of cocoon ourselves in a little Christian bubble where we feel safe. Or maybe there's the other end of the spectrum where we go to and you say, well, actually it's okay because Jesus has rescued us from all those things. I'm saved by grace through faith, not by what I do. So it doesn't matter. Well, I do two ends of the spectrum. I think they're both wrong. I think they are both wrong. But the end of the spectrum that Paul is dealing with in this particular letter is that second end. The one where we're more tempted just to say, it's okay, I'm saved by grace through faith. I can do pretty much whatever I want. Rather than the Christian bubble cocoon area. Now, it might be that the issue that Paul addresses here, idol offerings and idol meat, isn't one that's pressing for many of us. I personally don't remember having gone to a meal where someone has offered their food to an idol beforehand. But there will be some people in here who have. Because of their cultural background, because of their perhaps a religious background, or maybe because they've gone to a retirement dinner where somebody's offered a toast to the fruits of my labour. You see, idol meat probably isn't one of those issues that we have to deal with. But the principles that Paul gives us are really important for helping us to know how to live. Because idol meat didn't have a thing in the Old Testament saying, thou shalt or thou shalt not. There was no rule in the Old Testament you could go to and say, okay, this is how I need to deal with this one. In the Bible, there are some things that are timeless rules that Jesus takes from the Old Testament and applies again. You shouldn't murder, you shouldn't commit adultery. Those things are wrong, don't do them. But then there are other things where perhaps there are grey areas, matters of conscience. Matters where the Bible doesn't say yes or no. They're matters of wisdom. And so in those areas we need to think, how do I actually act? Let me give you an example. Let me take you back to Wednesday the 25th of May 2005. I'm sure many of you will remember it. It was a fantastic night. At 7:45 p.m. Tim probably definitely remembers this one. 7:45 p.m. The final of the Champions League kicked off at the Atatürk Stadium, Istanbul. At 8 p.m. the church family prayer meeting began in Edgerton Hall, Sheffield. Imagine a small group leader from that church. The football team he supports is playing in the most important match for 20 years. Most of his lifetime. The church he belongs to is about to meet to pray in their every month prayer meeting. What should he do? There isn't any verse that says, thou shalt go to the monthly prayer meeting at all costs. It's an issue of wisdom. It's a matter of conscience. Now, most of you probably get a bit of an inkling as to what I should have, what he should have done in that situation. But there are lots of things to consider. It may be that football isn't your thing. It may be that instead it might be something just trivial like our shopping habits. The cars we drive, clubbing, drinking alcohol, I don't know. But the simple rule of thumb that Paul gives us, and that Paul gives us in this passage, is there in verse 1. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. You want to be part of a healthy church? You want to be a healthy member? Well, listen to what Paul's got to say. And maybe you're looking into Christian things. See how the Bible encourages Christians to look out for one another. It's a really good way of living. See if you think that this God is worth listening to, worth following. So three pieces of advice for making these decisions. Firstly, this knowledge puffs up. This knowledge puffs up. I look around here and there's lots of knowledge in a room like this. There's medical knowledge. There's quite a bit of scientific knowledge going on in here as well. There's some knowledge of the arts. There's some Bible knowledge. There's knowledge of Peppa Pig. And of course, knowledge of Doctor Who as well. You guys in here have a great amount of knowledge. That's a good thing. Paul isn't anti-knowledge. Paul's not saying you shouldn't have learning. He studied hard for his exams. He did really well in his Pharisee school. No one could ever accuse him of being dumb or anti-academic. And actually, even in chapter 1, verse 5, he even gives thanks to God that they were enriched in all speech and all knowledge. The Corinthians have knowledge, and Paul's thankful for it. But the problem is not knowledge per se, not knowledge in and of itself. That word at the start of that sentence, this knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. That's the problem. It's not knowledge in and of itself. It's a specific type of self-centered knowledge that they have. Start of verse 1. We know that all of us possesses knowledge. The speech marks there, they're not there in the Greek, but I think they should start at the we. The Corinthians are going, we know that we've all possessed knowledge. It's self-centered knowledge. It's look at me knowledge. It's I've got knowledge, and it's puffing up and giving them a big head. You see, they know what you might consider to be the doctrine of redemption. They know that they have been saved from idol worship. They know they've been saved from death and slavery and hell and all of those things. They know it in their heads. And they're going, look at our Bible knowledge, we know it. But the question is, do they really know it? Because they're going, look at what I know. It becomes self-centered, it becomes puffed up. Big heads. The heads that were full of self-centered, look at me knowledge, were useless. Not because of the content of that knowledge, not because of the fact that they, because the gospel isn't useless, let's face it, that knowledge of it, but it was all about them. It's the way they used their knowledge that made it useless. They wanted to be the gurus that others turned to for advice. They probably sounded very wise. But the problem is that they were saying, we know stuff. Not, actually, what was more important was not what they know, but that they know. Their knowledge wasn't wise. It was conceited. It wasn't humble. It was proud. And so Paul says in verse 2, if anyone imagines that he knows something, the moment you start thinking, yeah, I've got knowledge, the moment you start comparing yourself to others and go, I know more than them, so really they ought to listen to me, it's the moment, actually, that we should start to realise we don't know what we ought to know. Because knowing God isn't about getting the answers right. It isn't about the facts and figures. It isn't about heads full of knowledge. No, knowing God is all about relationship. It's a genuine way of living. You see, they had all this knowledge. You see it in verse 4. as to eating of food offered to idols. We know that idols have no real existence. That there's no God but one. Verse 8, food will not commend us to God. We're no worse off if we do not eat, and no better off if we do. You see, they know the facts. They know that eating and drinking isn't going to affect their salvation. And they're right. But that truth puffs up. It's not a genuine relational knowledge. They knew they were free, but they didn't use it in a loving way. So imagine a 26-year-old small group leader deciding what he would do again with that Wednesday evening. What does he think to himself? He thinks, well, I don't need to go to the prayer meeting tonight because I can pray any night. In fact, I'll probably be praying more tonight than I would be if I was at the church prayer meeting. But this opportunity to go and watch this match, that doesn't crop up every day. It's not every month. It's almost once in a lifetime. It's a great opportunity. Why miss that? For a prayer meeting, I'm free. I'm not saved by my prayers. You see, when we have this kind of knowledge, self-centered knowledge, we can use it to justify what we want to do. Again, it becomes about me. It's self-seeking, self-justifying, self-exalting. It's theoretical. It's forensic. And even though the theology might be perfect, it's dead knowledge. And I think this is a danger for all of us, actually. When we're in a relatively intellectual background, then actually this kind of theoretical knowledge is a real danger. Rather than theoretical knowledge, we need a loving knowledge, a knowledge of God. Verse 3, if anyone loves God, he is known by God. You see, we don't want to be like children. We don't want to be like in a lecture theatre, listening to what the Bible has to say and filling our head with facts. We want to be like children, listening to a father, wanting to know him more, desiring to deepen in our love for him. True knowledge, living knowledge, excellent knowledge is a loving knowledge. Knowledge will build up the whole person when it is a loving knowledge of God. We need to know God. We need to experience him. Not knowing about God, but knowing him. It's not a factual knowledge. It's a relational knowledge. It's experienced, not forensic. So, verse 3 is this loving interaction that goes on. As we love God, we are known by him. And he loves us and we know him. It's what happens in any relationship, isn't it? That the interaction of love and knowledge goes hand in hand. As you love someone more, you learn more of them. And you find more reason to love them. That's how relationships work. That's how marriage works. The longer you're in a marriage, the more reason, generally, you have to love the person you're married to. Because the more you know them. So loving God. Loving God is what we are called to. If we think about this story here, the idle waters around the guy in the boat. You see, the danger is that we think that salvation is a forensic thing. We're saved from the waters around there. We're saved from all these dangers. But, as Paul says in 1 Thessalonians, that we are saved from worshipping idols to serve the true and living God. To relate to God. It's not that we're released from, it's not a get out of jail free card. But it's being adopted into a family of God where we call him Father, serving a new Lord. And so this is the life that we're called to. Love builds up. Love builds up. Love without knowledge is ineffective. I mean, you can love somebody by listening to them, but if you don't know anything, you can't really help them. Knowledge is important. A loving knowledge is vital. God calls us to this loving knowledge. Two elements of this love that we're going to touch on briefly. Firstly, verses 4 to 6. This love is an exclusive love for the Lord. Look at verse 6. For us there is one God, the Father, from whom are all things, and for whom we exist. And one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we exist. Most commentators seem to think this idea of one God and one Lord picks up on Old Testament language from Deuteronomy chapter 6. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. And then where does that go? What's the next verse? You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. You see, here is, if you like, the theory. Here is the, this is the theology, but it leads to loving the Lord your God exclusively. Rescued from false worship, rescued from idols, to serve the true and living God. Christian freedom isn't just freedom from false gods. It is freedom to serve the Lord wholeheartedly. It's being transferred from Manchester United to Liverpool. It is glory. It's a great opportunity to serve a new God. It's fantastic. You've got a new Lord now. Don't let those old false gods enslave you. But you've got new purpose, new meaning, new inclination, new opportunity. New priorities, good priorities to bless you and to grow you like a tree planted by streams of living water. You see, by loving the Lord as our priority, we are going to be built up ourselves. Love builds up. So let's revisit our illustration. Would going to watch the football in the pub demonstrate exclusive love for the Lord, my God? Or would it demonstrate exclusive love for Liverpool Football Club? At that moment of decision, where did my priority lie? Of course, there's freedom to choose. But that doesn't mean that both are equally beneficial. If Paul is right here in these verses, from whom, the God and Father, from whom are all things, and for whom we exist. My existence, your existence, is for God the Father, lived out through Jesus, my Lord. My time is for the Lord, my money is for the Lord, my body is for the Lord. And my life is to be lived in the pattern of the Lord Jesus, who demonstrated and practiced total obedience to his Father. So what does this look like? We need to think about what this exclusive love for the Lord looks like. But perhaps more astounding, more surprising, is our final little bit to look at. It is particularly astounding in our culture, which prioritizes all about my rights. And it's this, an exhaustive love for others. Verse 7 to 13. In our rights culture, it's all about what I can do. It's what about me. Nobody else matters. As long as I can do what I want, then it doesn't matter, does it? So whether it's the right to marry, or the right to bear arms, the right to freedom of speech, the right to die, or the right to live, my human rights are fundamental. That's why we're doing a series on God, my rights, and the gospel. Or God, rights, and the gospel in the evening service during next month. But when all we care about is exercising my rights, that's when war starts. Conflict erupts because, well, two people's rights impact on one another. So consider the journalist. The journalist has a right to freedom of speech, doesn't he? We all say freedom of speech, great. The celebrity has a right to privacy. Whose right wins? Does the right to privacy, and so everybody hush-hushes? Or does the right to freedom of speech, in which case suddenly the story gets blown open and then celebrity's exposed? Two individual rights which clash. And when they clash, that's when conflict begins. One person's right impacting on another. You see, in the world, we cannot reconcile human rights. In the church, we can. Because in the church, what Paul says in these verses is that everybody else matters more than me exercising my rights. The person sat next to you is more important than you doing what you have the right to do. The priority for the Christian is that I use my rights in a way that will liberate others to live their lives as well as possible in relationship with God. So, this is all a matter of conscience. It's a matter where there's no obvious right or wrong. So we come back. God's given us consciences to learn from. And so Paul speaks, you can see in these verses, conscience comes through frequently. So, we have different consciences, don't we? Some people think it's fine to drink alcohol. Some people think it's fine to get a tattoo or nip into Tesco's on a Sunday. Other people think that those things are absolutely wrong, and probably more likely all of those things are wrong. But the thing is, the issue for Paul is if you do something that you think is fine, will it encourage somebody else to act against their consciences? Because this waters, the waters that surround us, will probably be different for each of us. The things that we've been saved from, the things that we're more tempted to or the more inclined to, will not be the same for every individual. So, for example, Wednesday the 25th of May 2005, the small group leader goes to the pub to watch football. He doesn't see a problem. He doesn't think it's wrong. And whenever for whatever reason, everybody in the church suddenly gets wind of what he's done. There's an individual there at the prayer meeting who thinks, I really would have wanted to go to that football match. He's suddenly battling. Oh, well, he has been battling with the priority of his football team, but he's acted in accordance with his conscience and gone to the prayer meeting. But then he hears, well, Paul Robinson went to watch the football, so why can't I? And next time he's there, faced with that same kind of issue, then he's more likely to go along because his small group leader went to the pub. The way that I acted was dumb because it had impact on others. Now, probably the rest of the people in the prayer meeting thought to themselves, well, I don't care whether Paul goes to the pub or not. But the way I acted on that particular event had impact on others. So I want to say that using this example, here we've got the person on the boat, haven't we? That person doesn't want to get back in the water. It's dangerous. The water holds a threat to him. So what would be the worst thing that could happen in this circumstance? Surely it would be somebody else comes swimming up to the side of the boat and says, look, it's fine in here. The water's great. Come and join me. Come and have a swim. That's the last thing that person needs to hear. Because the danger is that by that one person going, it's okay, I can swim. I'm a strong enough swimmer. I can cope with it. It's nothing. That person is then drawn away from the safety, away from the loving relationship that they have with the Lord to something else. I'm just going to quickly show you from verse 7 onwards what happens when this takes place. Verse 7, their conscience is defiled. Verse 7, their conscience is defiled. Verse 9, my right becomes a stumbling block to others. Verse 10, he will be encouraged to do what I do. Verse 11, the one for whom Christ died is destroyed by my unloving knowledge. Verse 12, I sin against them and against Christ. That middle bit in verse 10, it says, will he not be encouraged if his conscience is weak to eat food offered to idols and be destroyed? If you notice a little footnote there, and footnote number 7, where it says, will he not be encouraged? Greek, built up. It's the same word as happens in verse 1. This knowledge puffs up, but love builds up. The question is, are you going to use your knowledge to love people, to build them up? Or are you going to build them up in the Lord? Or are you going to build them up in a way that leads them to destruction? That's the option that Paul gives. Give people confidence to grow in the Lord, or confidence to destroy and defile their consciences. That's the choice. How are you going to act? Jesus died for these people. Will we destroy them? Will we destroy one another if we act selfishly? And Maureen Greaves has just struck so many of us recently by her words over the last year, I guess. But she was recently speaking on Radio 4. She said these words about the people who had murdered her husband a year ago, last Christmas. I looked across at them and found myself thinking, why am I forgiving these people? They've taken from me the person I loved most in the world. And they've taken from me the person who loved me most in the world. And yet it wasn't long before I was kind of settling down and praying to God and saying again, Father, give me the ability to keep on forgiving them as I know you keep on forgiving me the wrongs that I do. What she's praying there is for God to give her the spiritual strength to treat others in the way that Christ treated her. Forgiving others as she has been forgiven. Christ died for us. So the question is, will we be prepared to die for the others for whom Christ died for? Giving up our rights. We don't want to be building others up to destruction in the way that we act. So, just a few thoughts here. In any congregation, we'll find people who've been redeemed from an idolatry of wealth. So let's be wise how we use our wealth, if we have it. People who've been redeemed from the snares of alcohol. So let's choose not to drink alcohol in their presence. It's fine in private. What about folk who've realised that their kids' achievements have become an idol? Let's not get into that competitive parent thing, which I think is just terrible, and I'm guilty of it. Maybe someone's just come to terms with their greed and their gluttony. You're out for a meal, why not order a salad? Now you can stop at McDonald's on the way home. You see, when you're with these people, identify the need and bear with them and help them and support them. Don't become a stumbling block. You see, someone's on this. Don't swim in the water around the outside. Join them on the boat. Be of comfort to them. Be of support to them. You see, if you think what I'm saying is a little bit too radical, read verse 13. If food makes my brother stumble, I will never eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. That's sacrifice. That's sacrificial giving, isn't it? Sacrificial living. Now, maybe that we're kind of sitting here and we're aware of kind of issues and we're thinking, yes, but. Because that's what I've been thinking all week. Yes, but. It all seems just a bit too much, Paul. But I want to suggest this morning that we need to pray for an attitude, a spiritual attitude from the Lord, that we say, not yes, but yes, Lord. Living a sacrificial life is always the way that love is demonstrated. My choosing not to exercise my rights for the sake of another is loving. And that's the way that actually Jesus himself showed the example of love. In the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus prays, not my will, but yours. He sacrifices his freedom for our sake. His life for our freedom. I'm speaking personally here. I think it's a lot easier to know about the crucifixion of Jesus. It's a lot easier to know the doctrinal effects than it is to live a crucified lifestyle. But the way that the Lord leads us and calls us is to take up our crosses and follow him. Not out of duty, but out of love. Love for him and love for one another. To lose our lives for the sake of others, that we might gain them. So in my decision making, I need to think, not just is this what I want to do, but how will this affect my family? How will this affect my church family? How will this affect my gospel team? How will this affect the person sitting four seats up from me right now? Because when the Lord spoke to Cain, he said, where is your brother? And he said, am I my brother's keeper? Well, yeah, we are. We are responsible for one another, supporting one another, helping one another. So the stakes are suddenly raised. But that's what being a mature Christian is all about. It's not about how much we know, but how we're going to sacrificially love one another in the way that Christ has loved us. Let's pray.